Harvey. Woohoo! By popular demand, we have brought him back.
I'm interested to see his opinion on so many things, so I'm glad you're back, Tom.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Welcome back. I'm so glad you agreed to do it again. And once again, you had another kind of scathing article on this episode that we're doing. There were two articles that you wrote during trial that troubled me. One was the lap episode we did, and this one, and I don't blame you for either article. I really don't. But these are probably two of the hardest days of the whole trial for me. So here's my PI tip of the day. Look for the helpers. Mr. Rogers used to say that his mom told him whenever there was a crisis, no matter how bad things were, look around. There are always people that are going to be helpers. And I find that to be true, and you'll hear of it even in this case. So no matter what's happening in life, there's always someone that's a helper. A lot of today, I want to talk about character and people's character and how it reveals itself, especially in a court setting. And I've said tons in the podcast, I say all the time that trials, pressure, reveal our character. They don't change us, they reveal us. That I see it so much in a trial. Like, okay, remember in the last episode, I was talking about iWorks, Jeremy's in-house attorney. I didn't meet with him once. I didn't meet with him twice. I think I met with him three times trying to get him to just tell the truth that he had looked at all of this and said, you can legally do everything that you're doing. And he wouldn't testify to that. And oh my gosh, I have never worked a witness so hard, like spent so much time with them.
If I remember correctly, this attorney was almost just out of law school. Is that right? And didn't have much experience.
He seemed like it.
Okay.
Yeah, he seemed very, very fresh, so he was terrified. I think he was absolutely terrified, and I kept trying to reassure him. And the third time I met with him, he actually met with Marcus and I. The three of us met, and we talked for like an hour and a half. And prior to that, like, because there had to be phone calls to even get the meeting. And I think he's a nice guy. I really do. Don't get me wrong. And I'm actually more surprised when people tell the truth in spite of the pressure the government puts on than I am by them doing whatever the government says. So just so you understand the spot that he was in. So like Tom says, he wasn't out of law school very long. And he's terrified in this whole scenario. Who wouldn't be? As I'm talking to him on the phone, I'm like, why are you so hesitant? Please meet with us. Marcus wants to talk to you. Marcus had cross-examined him some by then because they kept interrupting his testimony for other witnesses as we were going along. So it gave us more time to talk to this guy. It was before our third meeting and the one that Marcus was going to join me on. In that meeting, that's when I was like, what is your hesitation? What's your deal? And he finally said, do you know that they can charge me with bank fraud? And I was like, what? They're not going to charge you with bank fraud? What? And he said, yeah. Look, the statute of limitations is 10 years. And I was legal counsel for these guys. I can't testify. He said, I can't testify that I told them I looked through this and everything looked okay. And I was so frustrated, mostly because I couldn't tell him anything different. Like, no, don't worry, the government will never go after you.
Hell, yeah, in this case, no one was safe. Yeah.
So I get it. I get it why he did what he did. And to this day, Jeremy does not have any bad feelings for him. In fact, I was talking to Jeremy about him just the other day, and I think he felt horrible about his testimony. And so he actually recently like came over to Jeremy's house and trying to mend the fence there a bit. Even though Jeremy never expressed anger ever towards that guy. I think I would have, but not Jeremy. So,
well, I know, but so he can't get on the stand and lie, and he can't tell the truth. So was he taken the fifth? No, seriously, how did he get out of
it? He didn't actually, he didn't lie. I wouldn't say that he lied, but I also wouldn't say he told the truth.
He just kind of hedged.
He just kind of hedged. And I get it. The government had pressured him to do so. And I was trying to pressure him to do otherwise, but apparently I was not very intimidating.
You don't have a big enough club.
I scare a lot of people, but not him.
You are a great girl.
A more experienced attorney would have told the government to go pound sand.
Yeah.
You know? Yes. I think you're absolutely right, Tom. So as the government finishes their part of the case, their last witness was their expert witness.
Wait, who was the expert for this time?
Oh my gosh, this guy I thought was the slimiest guy. I don't know if you remember him,
no,
Tom.
No, I don't.
And here's what bugged me about the guy. An expert can sit in the courtroom the entire time. Most time, like even in this case and almost every case, they have an exclusionary rule. So witnesses cannot sit in the courtroom.
Sense.
But an expert is allowed to sit in the courtroom and listen to everyone's testimony throughout the whole thing so that they can know what's being said and then explain it because they're the expert in that field. So in this field, it had to be an expert in the internet. So this guy was an expert in the internet. You will probably be shocked to know he was an expert because he processed a lot of porn.
Well, there's an expert, and then there's an expert.
Uh-huh. Yes, and that was the government's expert. Of course, the government didn't bring that out. Like, what was it you were selling online? They never mentioned that.
That
not
would
important,
discredit him so
apparently.
Quick.
Right, and I kept begging Marcus, please ask him, what did you sell online anyway? Since you have all this experience on the internet, what were you marketing on the internet? They never asked. The jury never heard it. In spite of just getting the crap kicked out of him most days by the prosecution and the judge, in my opinion, he was a gentleman. He could have played dirty, and he didn't. He didn't bring that up. And that's going to become an issue later when we get to the end of the trial. Then it's the defense's time. And remember the two Idaho guys I was talking about?
Yeah.
I say all the time that I love Idaho boys. I decided my new phrase is, I love Idaho spuds and Idaho studs.
Oh, be careful. That could end up on a t-shirt.
Yeah. So these two Idaho studs. Here's what's amazing to me. We just got done talking about character. And you're going to see in this episode, we're going to show you like 180 degree flips in people's character. That's what happened in this case. So as we were getting ready, one of our first witnesses for the defense, now it's our turn to present our case, right? One of our first witnesses were those two Idaho guys, Shane Fisher and Jeremy Livingston.
Remind us really quickly what brought them into this case.
So remember there are like a few middle guys between Jeremy and the bank and Visa. So it goes from iWorks, Jeremy and his company iWorks. The next level is Mach 1. And that is the Idaho guys. They're the middle guys between Jeremy and CardFlex. Okay. They're above Mach 1. CardFlex is California. Andy Phillips, and you will hear about Andy Phillips in this episode. And then from Andy Phillips, then it goes to First Data and Visa and Wells Fargo. Like,
it's always good to kind of review where everybody stacks.
Yes. So I spent time with every witness. We had, I remember we put Kenneth Miller on. He was a banker from St. George. I spent an hour with that guy before we put him on.
I do know him.
You know Ken. You're friends with him
on
Facebook. Because I remember thinking, how does Shelly know my friend?
He's family.
Yes. Ken was awesome.
He's a great guy.
He was a banker. Yes. And he was consistently great with me in our case. We put him on the stand. I probably spent a couple hours with him, prepping him. His testimony was maybe 15 minutes. But that's how you prep for trial. Like, you prep a long time. You do all the prepping, then you cross your fingers and really hope that they do what they said they were saying they were going to, that they told me what they were going to say. So the ones I was nervous about were these Idaho guys, because I had heard that they were upset with Jeremy. And before they would even meet with us to talk about testifying, they wanted to meet with Jeremy. Well, remember, Jeremy can't meet alone.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So after we'd met with Ken Miller, then we were meeting with Jeremy Livingston and Shane Fisher, the Idaho guys. And I was a little nervous about it because I'd heard they were upset with Jeremy. We met at a hotel downtown, right by the courthouse, in like a conference room so that we could work all this stuff out. And I had Brad, Marcus's brother, with me. And Jeremy, the three of us with these two Idaho guys. I'd never met them before. I'd talked to them on the phone to arrange it, but they were like, we want to talk to Jeremy. You know, we're not very happy with some things. Okay. Now, see, these guys, they anybody involved with this, the FTC, the government was going after everyone. They went after these guys. They sued these guys. So everyone is terrified to talk. Everyone's terrified to testify. And I don't blame any of them. I really don't.
When it's your livelihood, everybody would be hesitant.
I found out later that the FTC sued him. And Shane he'd been very successful before he even met Jeremy. Like, he'd made a couple $1 million on his own. He was very successful, but the FTC was going after him for everything. They weren't going to say, oh, well, you made that money before. What they said is, you were involved in this shady deal, and you must have made it all from bad stuff, so we're going to take all your money. So Shane hired an attorney to help negotiate with him with the FTC, and I just learned recently he charged him $50,000, and then he told Shane to give him everything he had. Well, crap, Shane, I would have done it for $25,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Crazy stuff. So you can see why everyone's scared. And I don't know if that settlement had happened. I don't think it was done by the time we were in trial. I doubt that he had negotiated. And I don't know what his final negotiation was. I just heard that part. I thought it was funny and sad. Mostly sad. My part was funny. His part's sad. But they were upset with Jeremy. Now remember, Jeremy had all these like bad affiliates, people coming in, doing bad charges and stuff. Remember this? And we weren't allowed to talk about affiliate fraud. And there was a lot of fraud going on. Someone had told these two guys that Jeremy was the one doing it and that he was lying about it.
That's why they wanted to talk with Jeremy.
Yeah, they don't know who to believe. Sure. They don't know what's going on. And so we have this meeting. It's, like I say, it's Brad and Jeremy and I and Shane and Jeremy Livingston. It was really tense, like very polite, but it was very tense. They were like, Jeremy, so-and-so told us that you were the one doing this. And Jeremy's like, why would I do that? That would destroy my own company. That doesn't even make sense. Right. I wouldn't do that. Right. Why would I do it? And the conversation went on a long time. You can imagine it was a very emotional conversation because these guys were now looking at losing everything they'd built up in their life by being connected to this. And we are putting them on the stand the next day. It was pretty tense, and I wasn't sure that they believed Jeremy by the end of our conversation. Yeah. At the end, everyone was very polite, but I don't know that they believed him. I just don't know. And so I said to them as we were walking out of the meeting, so what are you guys going to do tomorrow? Because they were still kind of upset.
Well, who wouldn't be?
And I said, what's going to happen tomorrow when you testify? And I remember both of them saying to me, well, we'll tell the truth. And I was like, oh, thank you. Please
But you're also hoping their thought of truth is the same as your thought of truth.
Exactly. So I really didn't know what that meant. You just don't know until they get on the stand. And that day, oh my gosh, the emotions of things, holy crap. This is the day that they called Marshall's in and they had Marshall stand up there next to Marcus. Tom, tell us, and I'd really like to hear from your side, what your thoughts were about that. You don't have a dog in that hunt.
No, I don't.
Were you in the courthouse every day?
Yes. This, how should we say it, this contest between Attorney Marcus Munford and the judge had been building for quite a while during the trial. Marcus is a scrapper, and somebody says no to him, he'll come back again and again on it. So you have that on the one side. On the other side, you had a judge who had very little trial experience and I think very little criminal. And I would say before he became a judge, no criminal experience, although I don't know that specifically. But he had been a real estate attorney and he had been a city attorney for like some town, Bigwater or something, down in some small town in southern Utah. And he didn't have a background in criminal law. And my opinion, which I'll frankly state right now, was that Judge Newfer was in over his head on this trial. Mm-hmm. I think Marcus was an experienced trial attorney, and he knew the rules of evidence. And I think that, on the one hand, that he kind of intimidated the judge because he really knew more about criminal law and criminal procedure than the judge did. And on the other hand, I don't think Judge Newfer was, I don't know, emotionally might be the word. He didn't have the courtroom demeanor that you see in federal judges.
Okay.
If I remember what happened here, Marcus was wanting to introduce some evidence that would counter one of the witnesses, who I think was Andy Phillips at that point. Mm-hmm. Marcus had an email that he said would undermine Andy Phillips' testimony, and the judge wouldn't let it in. I don't remember that there was even a discussion about why not at that point, okay. But the judge wouldn't let it in. And Marcus insisted, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Pam, but I think that's when the judge called the security officer there and had him stand by the desk. And of course, this wasn't the first and only time that that happened in the trial.
But it was the only time I've ever seen it in my life.
Right. Right.
It happened a lot of times in this trial with Marcus, but I'd never seen it in a courtroom.
Right.
And there were times the judge, he'd put us in timeout. He'd put Marcus in timeout.
Yeah.
You remember this?
Yeah.
Like, like he'd say, do we need a timeout, Mr. Mumford?
Which seriously? And so,
it seemed to me like we were in daycare, you know, kiddie daycare.
Oh, it totally did. Point, you know? It totally did. And when that would happen, I was sending Marcus a message. I'd say, please, I'm begging you to go stand in the corner. Oh. Just go stand in the corner.
I don't know that would have been.
Because you know how they do that? You know how they do that in grade school? Like, you go stand in the corner, like you're in trouble. And one time I remember we were in timeout, and Marcus was in timeout. Rob Lunnan tried to continue with questioning. He had some question that he thought, well, since Marcus is in timeout, I can deal with this issue with the judge. And so he said, Your Honor, and the judge was so mad. And he's like, Mr. Lunnan, we are in timeout. Like, we're all sitting there.
I know. It was a bizarre, thing.
And Rob Lunnan, he didn't even know what to do. He's like, oh, okay, Your Honor. Like, I get it. He didn't know that we were all in timeout. We all thought only Marcus was. Because.
Yeah.
Like, it was so crazy.
So, in a contest, Marcus, I can see why he would infuriate a judge because, you know, and I've sat through him in other trials even, and he is a bulldog, and he'll just continue and continue and continue. So I can see why they would get mad at him. But I sat not too long after the Jeremy Johnson trial. I sat through most of the trial of Rick Kerber when Marcus was the attorney. And Judge Shelby was the judge, the federal judge in that case, too.
Uh-huh.
And Shelby did such a better job of handling Marcus Mumford in that case. There was no outburst. There was no timeouts. There was no calling security and stuff, you know.
Really?
And stuff. And that just showed me the contrast between the two judges and their courtroom, their knowledge their experience and their lack of experience. Yeah.
So, Tom, how are you feeling about where this is going? Does it feel as out of balance as it seems to me hearing it the first time?
Yes, it does. I mean, it was that, well, there was a number of things, I guess. I mean, it was the prosecution team, which I thought was kind of over the top themselves, zealous in this case. Okay. And they had lost their kind of professional distance from this case, and they became emotionally involved and personally involved, and they were out to get Jeremy Johnson.
Okay.
Yeah.
They felt insulted by the way he was fighting back their attempts to throw him in prison, you know, and stuff. And then there was, you know, the judge in the case. It, like I had just said, it was seemed to be so inexperienced and so... There was something not quite right about him in this trial. You know, he was, I've had attorneys tell me lately that they thought there was something going on in his life, maybe family matters or something like that, that affected his behavior. But it was just totally out of the norm of anything I had ever experienced in federal court.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then, of course, you had a couple of guys who were defending themselves and that don't know the rules, you know.
And you got a bunch of hillbillies in the gallery.
Yeah. Hello.
All of us.
Behind that fence. Like, get back.
And some hillbillies on the other side of the fence. So that we were everywhere. We were everywhere.
Yeah.
Bunch of rednecks is what we were. Uh-huh. So, okay. So I wanted to jump into, so Shane Fisher's testifying. Now he's the Mach 1 guy. He's the Idaho guy they introduced Jeremy to Andy Phillips. Now, Andy Phillips is Cardflex, is his company. Okay. And Andy was like the godfather of merchant processing. Like, he is one of the few in the country. And he was big. He made a lot of money. And Jeremy was needing help because he'd been put on the match list because of all the chargebacks that were happening. And he was trying to figure out what to do. So anyway, they meet. These Idaho guys say, hey, we know someone that this guy's like the godfather of merchant processing. He is in California. He's dealt with this before. We can help you. So here's his testimony. And Brad Mumford was doing the direct exam on this because he's our witness. And so he's explaining that Jeremy had explained that I've got these bad affiliates that come in here and charge. Now, he said that on the stand, and he says, so we had to establish a method of how iWorks and CardFlex were going to work together to deal with this. And Brad asks, and what method did you come up with? I guess, did you come up with a method? And he answers, yes, Andy and Jeremy. And the government objects. Tom, have you ever heard more objections in a trial in your entire life?
No, I don't.
I mean, I've never. It's just constantly this barrage of objections. So the government objects. On that one, it was overruled because it was Brad. What I noticed in reading through the transcript is the judge was a little kinder to Brad than he was to Marcus. Brad is Marcus's brother. So more questions were allowed during Brad's examination, but he only did a few witnesses. So Shane explains, Jeremy told Andy that he was having chargeback problems because affiliates were sending bad traffic to him. And the government objects. The witness says, Andy told Jeremy, hey, I dealt with this before in the porn industry. Okay, so Andy tells him, I've dealt with kind of affiliate fraud stuff that happened. What Shane testifies is, if you break the corporations up, it will help you identify where the bad traffic is coming from.
Okay, now wait. He's on the stand saying this right now.
Yes. Then he goes into, just a few minutes later, Brad asks him about these chargebacks and how they decided to deal with it. And Shane answers, the chargebacks are still coming in. They're not identifying where the bad traffic is coming from. So CardFlex is recommending to break up the processing up further to have a better scope to see, and I guess identify where the bad traffic is coming in from. Now, this is absolutely crucial because in a minute, Andy Phillips is going to get on the stand and testify something else. So when I say that he told him to split that up, that's when he told him to create all those shell companies, right? Jeremy's testimony is he was told to create shell companies. Shane is just now testifying. And I'm sitting in the gallery going, oh, thank you. Finally. Like, someone is telling the truth. And I didn't know, because they'd been upset last night, if he was really going to tell the truth. And this is where I'm saying, like, we really see people's character when they get in stress. This guy was under major amount of stress.
Right.
And that he would sit there and tell the truth. Yeah. I am constantly impressed and in awe of people that have the character that when the heat is on, that they still do the right thing. That they still tell the truth. They still do. And I really understand why people don't. But man, when they do, honestly, it brings tears to my eyes. These guys were facing losing everything they had from the FTC. They weren't involved in the criminal stuff. And anything they say can and will be used against them in court, I guarantee it. But he is testifying, and here, so they'd just been asking him about these companies. And Brad had just introduced an email that used the term shell, a shell company. Remember how I told you at the very beginning of this, like, Wells Fargo had like 3,000 shell companies. First Data has like 4,000 shell companies. But now we're in trial. They're using the shell company as like, ooh, like just the fact that it's a shell company, that it's a bad thing. And so Marcus says, now we're displaying this for the jury. When you receive this, and they're talking about an email that he's looking at, he said, do you have an understanding, I guess, of the term shell or shell corp? And Shane says, yes. This is the question from Brad. Did it surprise you when you received this email to have Mr. Johnson referring to shell corp there in that email? Answer, no. And he says, and why not? And Shane answers, that was a terminology used any time he was talking about the additional corps that have been discussed to either do business with someone that he was doing customer service and processing for, or his proprietary businesses that they were breaking apart. So Jeremy had both. He had companies that he did processing for, and he also had his company that he was splitting into different shell companies. So there were a lot of companies that they were trying to analyze. I was like, I'm serious. I was sitting there with like butterflies and rainbows and all happy things like, yay, someone tells the truth. Well, but here's what we knew. Andy Phillips was our next witness. Andy is the CardFlex guy. He's the godfather of merchant processing. Well, I told you, I spend hours prepping a witness, interviewing them. What are you going to say? What if when they say this, what will you say? Andy, every time I'd called Andy, he wouldn't return my phone calls. If I left messages at his business, he wouldn't return them. I sent emails, he wouldn't return it. I left messages with his secretaries, he wouldn't return it. And I was saying, I don't know if we should subpoena this guy to even bring him
right
here.
Right.
Well, Jeremy's like, look, he's crucial. He's the one that told us to put these shell companies together.
Okay.
So right after we get done with interviewing Jeremy Livingston and Shane Fisher that night, remember that intense meeting that we had?
Right.
I finally get home. It's like 9:30, almost 10 o'clock at night. And we get an email from Jason Burt, the prosecutor. And the subject of the email may as well have said, nah, 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 nah. Because, I'm serious, he may as well have said it. Because what he had just sent Marcus and Jeremy an email to notify them, hey, just so you know, we just got done meeting with your witness, Andy Phillips, and he's rolling over on you guys.
For hell's sakes.
So now we're on the phone from like 10 o'clock to 12, I don't know. We were on the phone, I think it was Jeremy and Marcus and Brad and I, trying to decide whether we put Andy Phillips on the stand. Here's my vote every time. No, yep. And hell no.
And capital
absolutely
H-E-L-L,
not.
Capital N-O. Uh-huh.
No, no freaking way should we put this guy on the stand. We just got a heads up from Jason Burt, the prosecutor, telling us, ha-ha, ha-ha, like, totally reminds me of the Pee Wee Herman laugh, like, ha, I got you guys. Like, your guy's going to roll over. He's going to testify. He's going to screw you guys over so bad.
He gave us a warning.
And Marcus and Jeremy are the eternal optimists. They argued with me over and over. No, no, no. We think we can just, like, keep the scope of the examination so tight that it will be okay. And I was like, no. I don't trust him. He never wanted to talk to us. He would never return my phone calls. Now he finally gets here and he takes the phone call from the government? No. And then he goes to their office and meets with them. And they give us a heads up. Let's like thank the Lord they gave us a heads up. And they said, well, what would we do? And I said, we'll tell him, we hope you enjoyed your night in Salt Lake. Here's your plane ticket. Go home. You don't even have to come to court. Just get the hell out of here.
You're not invited. Yeah.
You're not invited to our party. We just uninvited you. We argued and argued.
Now, if by chance you guys decided that, like if you said, okay, we're not going to call you as a witness, because it's the defense's time to call their witnesses, the prosecution could not call him. Is that correct?
Correct.
They already said, okay, we're done.
It, with the exception that they could call
rebuttal.
Him as a rebuttal witness.
Yeah.
Okay.
They could have
that's
him be their rebuttal witness.
Okay, that's good to know. Thank you.
But I don't think they would have put him on as a rebuttal because he wasn't terribly friendly to anyone because he was in a really crappy spot.
Yeah.
The FTC went after him. He wasn't happy to be there, but he was way, way more scared of the government than he was of us.
Which you can't blame him because the government.
Yes, I can.
Like,
I want to blame him.
Okay.
No,
but I mean,
you're absolutely right. No,
and
you're right.
He should get on and tell the damn truth. That's the bottom line. But the government's doing such crazy things and going after people for such crazy reasons. That's scary that they feel like have that power.
Right, exactly. Tom, did you know that we had a heads up on that?
No, I don't think I did know that. Uh-uh.
When Shane Fisher finishes testifying, he can now stay in the courtroom. And what I know is he did. He stayed in the courtroom to watch. Now, Andy Phillips, he considered Andy a friend. So he thought, hey, cool, I'm going to listen to Andy's testimony. When he hears Andy start testifying and lying in Shane's opinion, Shane got so upset, he got up and stormed out of the courtroom.
Oh, wow.
They had been friends for a long time, and my understanding is they've never spoken since.
Well, that would do it.
I mean, emotions were so, so high. Remember, I had been arguing, please let's not put him on. I lost that argument. They put him on. And the next morning, I was still begging, like, we can still change our minds. Please let's not put him on. And Jeremy said, no, we're just going to limit the scope. Remember how I explained that whatever we talk about, they have to stay in that, in those parameter guidelines. That's right. That's in an ordinary trial.
Yeah, this one hasn't been the best.
This is right. Not an ordinary trial. Do I believe the judge is going to make them stay to our scope? No, I don't. No. I really don't. So I'm terrified. I'm like, please, no, no, no. And when Andy Phillips got on the stand, emotions were so, so high. Like, from everyone. I mean, it was almost like, it was like a verbal brawl between Jason Burt and Marcus and the judge. And I just want to read just a little bit. So Marcus is trying to get an exhibit in. And Tom, you'd referred to this a little earlier. And Marcus is explaining, we have a copy of this, Your Honor. Now, when you have something to enter into evidence, you have to lay a foundation for why that should be part of the case. And okay, to do that, you ask the witness questions, and then you'll say, like, here's an email. Does this refresh your memory? Or here's an email. Does this look familiar? What is it? And then they'll explain it. And then you say, I moved to put this in. And okay, so that's kind of what's happening there. And Marcus is saying, I have a copy of this, Your Honor, that I can provide to the witness. And Marcus asks, do you see that it refers to the Wells audit? Government, Mr. Jason Burt, objection, it's not in evidence. The judge, it's not in evidence. They both, like, jump all over Marcus because it's not in there. And Marcus says, Your Honor, I move to admit it. Jason Burt, objection, I object on relevance, and it's also hearsay, Judge. The judge, sustained, take it down. I mean, take it down, like, you can't even look at it. Usually, they'll let the witness look, and then they'll decide, but he didn't even want the witness to look. He says, take it down. And then Marcus asks him, did this refer back to the meeting that you had with Wells Fargo? And the prosecutor, Your Honor, he hadn't even objected. All he said is, Your Honor, and the judge answers, sustained. And he says, you're admonished, Mr. Mumford. So Marcus asks, Mr. Phillips, did you not tell the representatives of First Data and Wells Fargo at this meeting that they knew who you were boarding, that they knew that this was Jeremy Johnson? And Jason Burt asked and answered, argumentative, leading. So he's given like three reasons, and the judge sustained. And so Marcus asks, well, let's talk about this meeting. First of all, in your relationship with First Data, were you invited to the President's Club? Jason Burt, irrelevant, judge. And he's referring to things in exhibit that are not received. The judge sustained.
Oh my gosh.
I've never, ever seen anything like this. It was so tense. They're still arguing. I just skipped through a bunch of pages of transcript, yeah, and it was just like contentious, objection, and sustaining. And Marcus wasn't hardly even getting anything answered. So Marcus, he's trying to explain why this is relevant to something. And the judge says, my ruling stands. That's it. We're done.
Wait, who said that?
The judge. And I've never seen a judge just do that. Like, you get to ask questions until you're done asking.
Yeah, I haven't even had a chance to ask right. him questions.
And so Marcus says, I can keep making attempts to lay foundation, though, right? I think I can. I've got a few more. And the judge says, no, you're done with that. It's a waste of time.
Wow. They weren't letting him build anything.
No, no. And so Marcus says, like, okay, well, take those down, I guess. I mean, it was so tense. Let me jump.
What are you thinking at this time, Tom, when you're seeing all this? Are you like as shocked as Pam sounds?
No, I was shocked at the judge, actually, and his behavior in this trial. Yeah. I didn't think that he understood the criminal procedure. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he cared to know
right.
criminal procedure or criminal right. law. You know, it's not like he would stop and look up a rule.
Right, right, right. It was
let's
like,
take a break. Yeah. Let me review
it
something.
It felt like this is how I feel, and I don't really care what the rules say. Yeah. I'm the judge, so.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So it was just like we've said, it was just so unusual. You just don't see these things. Federal court is just kind of staid, boring,
yes.
dry
yes.
place.
Uh-huh.
The judges, by and large, are pretty good.
Yeah.
This just wasn't the case here.
Wow.
Oh, you know? Not at all. So like a few minutes later, Marcus is still trying to get evidence in and information in and questions answered, and he's getting objected to constantly. So Marcus asks, you sent this to Mr. Johnston in March of 2010? And the answer is yes, sir. And Jason Burt says, "Your Honor, I object. Exhibit is not received. He can't ask questions about it." The judge, sustained. Marcus, "I'm trying to lay some foundation, Your Honor," which is what you do.
Right.
They usually give the lawyer a lot of leeway, like, go ahead, lay your foundation, let's see if you go somewhere, and then I'll rule whether it's really relevant or not.
Right.
And just asking the question, you know, did you send us email to this guy? That's foundation.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So Marcus says, "I'm trying to lay some foundation, Your Honor," and the judge, "More foundation isn't going to help relevance." And Marcus asks, "Can I approach, Your Honor, so that we're not arguing in front of the children?"
Right.
So we're not arguing in front of the jury. He just says, "Can I approach, Your Honor?" And the judge says, "No, move on."
Wow.
And Marcus says, "Well, can I ask him if I'm going to show him, Your Honor, without?" And the judge says, "Just ask a question." Like, you can feel the tensions building up just even from me reading this.
Uh-huh.
And this is when it gets so bad that the judge actually gets so mad he stops the proceeding and says, "We're at recess. Like, you're done. We're at recess." And we all go to recess. And that was when I came back and marshals were standing on either side of Marcus. There were marshals on the bench between Tom and I. Guess they were trying to separate us too, Tom. They did.
Well, you two heavy hitters, you got to stay behind your family.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was so, so bad. The tensions.
Tom,
how did you
feel about having a marshal that close to you? Was that kind of unsettling or a little bit different or what?
It was totally different, you know. I think it was totally
Tom loved it.
Not proper at all.
Okay, good. Good. Good.
But I do agree, somebody had to control Pamela. Something had to be done.
So this was all her. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, but then they found out they couldn't control me, so they gave up.
Yeah.
So then
a lost cause.
Yeah, pretty much. Truly, I've never seen the stress of this. And I'm freaking out because not only is this like embarrassing and humiliating for Marcus, and I don't think Marcus deserved it at all. But this is all happening in front of a jury.
Yeah.
What can the jury possibly think? How could they ever come to a conclusion that we didn't do anything bad when the judge is, like, ready to throw the attorney in jail just for asking questions?
Yeah, that's so
Well, funny. The judge is not just telegraphing things to the jury, but being rather blatant about where he stands.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, I think I would understand I don't know if it was fear-based or a power move, if you were dealing with a murderer. Someone who had gone in and killed a bunch of people, and you're like, we don't know where this guy's going to come over the table or if he's going to come after the judge or something and bring in the marshals. But just because he's asking all these questions, that just seems like ridiculous.
Oh, and I've done a lot of criminal cases where my clients were murderers.
Yeah.
I've never had anyone be treated like this, ever. Yeah.
And it's not even the person, it's your attorney. Gosh.
Remember, Pamela, that I don't know if it was at this point, but at some point in the trial, Judge Benson came down to observe because it was such a circus.
Well, do you know why, Tom? Because you wrote an article about it. So, literally, no, I'm not kidding. I think it was after this day that the next day Judge Benson came in. And for a time, Judge Benson was the chief judge in federal court.
Oh, wow.
I remember I got there and looked back and I saw Judge Benson walk in. And I was like, ha-ha. Like, the judge is in trouble. And I noticed that the judge did not do any of his shenanigans the day Judge Benson was watching. None of that crap happened.
Oh, no.
He didn't call timeout. He didn't call marshals on him. He acted, like, so polite and nice. It reminded me, like, when your car doesn't work and it's, like, making a horrible sound. You get into the shop and you're like, honest, it's making this horrible sound. And then all of a sudden it's not making a sound.
Because
I'm like, wait a minute. Because Tom had just done this report about how horrible the courtroom was and what the judge did. And so now all these guys, like, honest, all these people from U.S. Attorney's Office, other judges would come observe. And I think they were all like, holy crap, what's happening in that courtroom?
Right.
And then he would all of a sudden behave. And I'm like, wait, what? So as if it were not bad enough when we were on direct exam with Andy Phillips, then came cross-exam. This was so horrible.
So if I understood, the only way cross-exam could ask something is if it was already been talked about, correct?
Yes.
So if all these objections are happening and if Marcus hasn't even been able to bring anything to light, what does the prosecution have to cross-examine?
You'll hear. They find stuff.
How can you legally?
They're not worried about legalities of things, Shelley.
Oh.
You're just being silly.
Okay. Tom, I'm really tight with Perry Mason, you know.
So. Yes. Yeah, you're thinking of TV court. In real court, it doesn't matter. So then it comes to cross-examine. Jason Bird is cross-examining Andy Phillips. And he says to him, with all these people, did you have any understanding at first that they were matched? So he's talking about all the shell companies. But remember, Jeremy, on every shell company, Jeremy was listed as the financial guarantor. I promise you, Andy Phillips would never have done business with any company that didn't have a financial guarantor that had the means to back up any chargeback. They,
sure.
They wouldn't have done it. And Jeremy's name was on all of those.
It wouldn't have been good business.
Yeah. Jason Bird asks, when, if ever, did you tell anybody at iWorks or Blaze, Mach 1, the Idaho guys? So he's asking, did you ever tell anyone at Jeremy's company or Shane Fisher's company to use shell companies to mask iWorks or to obtain different merchant accounts for iWorks? And Andy Phillips answers, never. And Marcus objects, and of course it's overruled. So then he asks, Mr. Phillips, do you have an opinion about Mr. Johnson's character? Now, just so you know, I'm sitting in the gallery. Remember, I had fought really hard to not have him on the stand. My heart was pounding so hard, you would have thought my life was on the line.
Uh-huh.
And I'm getting, like, stressed. And he says, do you have an opinion about Mr. Johnson's character? Answer by Mr. Phillips. I do. What is that opinion? Answer. He puts up a really good front. And when I met him, I thought he was philanthropic. Legitimate, brilliant, honest, looked me in the eye. But over the years, I've come to learn that's not the case. And the question, how so? Now, notice the leeway. Like, they just get to just talk like they're having a conversation.
Yeah.
This is so wrong.
And he says, how so? Answer, well, he darn near destroyed my company. I spent 30 years building by greed and just by taking advantage of, I don't know, I shouldn't say my naivety. This is the godfather of merchant accounts.
Oh, my God.
So here's the thing. When Shane Fisher testified, what I didn't include was Shane said that Andy Phillips explained that, hey, I used to do a lot of processing merchants online for porn, and they had a lot of affiliate fraud. And so what we did at that time was we created a lot of shell companies to clean it up. And so I suggest that's what we do. Now he's testifying, and what he says is, this was my naivety. I shouldn't be naive after this many years, but I wasn't accustomed to this. Again, I'll go back to the days. Yeah, he goes, I'll go back to the days I was processing for a lot of the adult guys. As bad as they are, those guys didn't lie to you. So question, do you feel now sitting here today, Mr. Johnson lied to you? Answer, yeah, I do.
Wow. Okay, I mean, so how was Jeremy? Was he like astounded, like melting? Like, what in the world is this guy doing? I mean, he thought this guy was his friend. Obviously.
The wheels were just falling off. I actually started crying. We kind of joked, the women in the courtroom, we joked, like the wives and like one of the attorneys, that we'd take turns crying. This was apparently my day to cry. And it was also the one day that one of my sisters showed up to watch me in court. Like, hey, you're on this big trial, I want to watch. She showed up right before Andy testified to these things. And so I'm crying. So just like Shane Fisher, I get up and leave. I can't take it anymore. I'm bawling.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm like, I got to get out of here. I can't be here. And then, just to make everything nicer, the next day, Tom Harvey puts it in the paper. Here's the headline that Tom went with. He darn near destroyed my company. Defense witness turns on Jeremy Johnson.
Wow.
Whoa.
All right, Tom, step up here. What's going on in your mind?
Well, as I put in the article,
right.
I think if I had been in the same position, I would have agreed with Pam.
Thank you, Tom.
At that point, it was a big mistake.
Huge mistake.
A huge mistake on Jeremy and Marcus's part to call this guy as a witness. Wow. It was just a big mistake. And I think this is the worst day of trial for Jeremy.
In my opinion, I thought it was too. Yep. And quoting from your article, you literally say, the day's testimony could prove a big strategic mistake for Johnson, who is acting as his own attorney as he tries to defend himself against 86 charges. And part of what Andy Phillips got into, the government, as their witness, had brought in William Swaim, who worked for Andy. Andy was the CEO, owner of CardFlex. And he brought Will Swaim in. The government brought him in before, like one of their last witnesses. I thought Will Swaim, I don't know if you remember him off the top of your head, Tom, but I thought he was a slick, smooth-talking, sleazy guy. And he testified that we had no idea about these shell corporations. We had no idea they were doing this. When in fact, I have multiple witnesses that were there when these guys told Jeremy to form shell companies, right?
Yeah.
But they testified, we didn't know that he did this. We just knew that he was processing for companies. And, you know, we know that Mormons do a lot of MLM. So they turned it into a religious thing, even on the stand.
Oh, my God.
Will Swaim did. And he's like, yeah, I think it was like Tupperware cells that they were doing. And I'm sitting there going, what in the hell? I've never heard this in my whole life. He literally just made that up on the stand.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
there's absolutely no evidence.
No evidence of a Tupperware cell anywhere in this. Anything. Yeah. And yet he was testifying to it. So then when Andy Phillips was testifying, he testified of the same thing. Like, I didn't know they're doing like Tupperware, like they had all these multiple shells and I didn't know they were all connected. It was so distressing. So literally I had to leave. It was my worst day. And it also happened to be the day that I had to make lunch for everyone. So I left the courtroom at home and made lunch and brought it back crying. And I'm trying not to cry now that everyone's coming in for lunch.
But wait, before you get to lunch, was the defense objecting? Like, objection, and was the...
No, you can't, like, when they say something like that, sometimes it's best just, like, that old joke when you find yourself in a pile of shit, the best move is keep your mouth shut.
Yeah. That's good.
And
yeah, that is good.
I think Andy Phillips brought us a whole pile of shit and we were just trying to keep our mouths shut at that point.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So there's another PI tip for you. If you find yourself in a pile of shit, keep your mouth shut.
You know what? My article also pointed out when Jeremy was questioning Phillips, but Phillips said that his understanding of what iWorks was up to came from the Federal Trade Commission. And he said that his opinion on iWorks, quote, based on information that was pounded down my throat by the Federal Trade Commission.
Yeah. Yes.
And so here he is,
you know, not right.
He's been sued by the FTC too as part of this. He's losing millions of dollars.
Well, and you know what? It serves him right for lying on the stand, the happy ass.
And then he meets with federal prosecutors who I'm sure were assuring him that he could get out of this whole mess.
Yeah.
And then the next day he gets up on the stand and testifies this way.
Yeah.
You know?
So. Liar. Wow.
And he testified as part of that. They said, you know, have you been sued by the FTC? Yes, I have been sued. The FTC sued him, I think, for $5 million. I think he settled for $3 million.
Wow.
Don't feel bad for him. Remember, he had Jeremy's reserve account. Plus, I also understand Jeremy had given him just under $1 million to start his own bank at that time, which Andy never gave that money back to him. Of course not.
Yeah, where's that money, Andy?
Yeah. I think he used it to help pay off the FTC. But we did ask on redirect, did you fight the FTC? Are you going to trial? And he said, no, because you can't beat City Hall. And it would have cost me $5 million in 5 years of my life to fight them. That was the exact quote. And I don't have the money or the time. So I settled with them.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, my opinion is the same about the Wells Fargo guys that got up and testified, too, that I felt, I mean, it was obvious that Wells Fargo knew about what was going on and was happy to do it because it was making them a bunch of money.
Right.
So they were just blowing smoke, basically. But I think it's the influence of the federal government, you know, when they go after you, even if you're a huge bank like Wells Fargo or you're particularly a smaller credit card processor type, you know, they have so much is at stake there. And I think the testimony bends toward the power.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what? That's a great phrase. Your testimony bends towards the power.
Yeah.
And the threat. The power and the threat.
Yeah.
Yeah. That says exactly. A lot right there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good phrase.
A lot of times, you know, it's a business decision, too. You know, we're going to get the FTC off our back and get back to making money.
Absolutely. And that's what Andy Phillips did. I understand Andy later sold his company, CardFlex, for like $100-something million. So you don't have to feel bad for Andy. He did okay, Shelley.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I'm heartbroken over here.
he's not going to be in the food line for help anytime soon. So yeah, that was like our toughest day at court. The next episode will be a lot more fun, I promise. Still tense.
Oh my gosh, this is killing me.
Still tense. Yeah. And we're getting to the end. So
okay, so Tom, what are you thinking about all this?
This was a day at trial that was really demonstrative of what the whole thing was like.
Yeah.
And what the problems were, particularly with the judge.
Mm-hmm.
Doing this podcast with Pam, and we've covered a lot of different cases, I've never seen one so out of balance. Like, defense doesn't even have a chance to put anything out, like to even ask a question, and then the prosecution has just free rein. And I think that's really sad.
Yeah, and you know, that's my opinion too. I've sat, like I said previously, I've sat through numerous federal court trials and state court trials, and I had never seen anything like this.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, it left me appalled at the justice system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scary. You don't ever want to, no offense, but I would be scared to death if I ended up in a situation like Jeremy did, because you just don't know that justice is out there. That's not right.
Yeah. I do think it usually works better than this. I really do. But this was absolutely appalling. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Jeremy, I mean, the guys that are fighting for their lives over here, we're hoping for a fair trial. I mean, that's what you're raised to believe. And it sure doesn't look like it happened. Scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we do actually have some fun, as tense as this was. And that day, I've got to tell you, when I told you I was crying in the break room, as I brought lunch in for everyone, as they came in, and the other women were like really sensitive to my crying. Mm-hmm. And I remember Scott's wife, Sandy, quoted a scripture for me, just like, help me understand, like, basically, like, hey, these are hard times. If I were a good scriptorian, I could tell you what it was, but I'm not. But that's when I finally asked her, like, man, I don't know how you guys did it. I don't know how you chose to face a trial instead of just taking a plea. And Sandy said, you know, Scott was really tempted to take the plea. And I said, you can't do it. You cannot plead to something that you didn't do. You can't say that you did bank fraud and money laundering when you didn't. Like, there's no way we can do that, Scott. And she, like, helped stand him up and supported him in fighting this. And I will, that was the day that I learned about that.
Like,
and I am
a snapshot moment.
Yeah, and I have never, I'm constantly in awe of the courage of these guys to go to trial. And I'm in awe when a witness like Shane Fisher and Jeremy Livingston take the stand and actually tell the truth in spite of the fact they're being sued by they were being sued by the FTC just like Andy Phillips was.
Yeah, yeah.
So when people do the right thing, like, thank the Lord for good characters out there, because you make our world a better place, and it gives me hope and faith in humanity and the justice system. This case doesn't give me much hope for the justice system, but this is why I did the podcast, because of this case. I was so, like Tom says, I was so appalled that I just thought, I've got to find a way to tell what happened.
Right.
And if I go to jail someday, I'm asking all of the listeners to please contribute to my defense fund.
Yeah.
telling all this.
I have to say, I've never looked at the justice system the same way after this trial.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Wow.
I was so, so appalled by what happened there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And I know I'm telling heartbreaking stuff, but I want people to know, like, I love that there are good people. And so I don't want it to just be dark. There are good people, like, for them to stand up when they were facing the pressure of the world and facing losing all their money, and Shane to tell the truth anyway.
Sure.
Like, thank the Lord for good people. And I don't want people to lose their faith in humanity, because there are, I'm still in awe of the character.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm not saying my guys, the defendants were perfect, because they're certainly not perfect. I told you we're like the hillbilly rednecks over there. Like, and we swear, some of them even say the F-bomb. Tom reported it. But I love them. So there is good everywhere, I promise. So thank you all for listening. The next episode, I promise, is much lighter, not as hard.
Not as dark.